Look who's calling the shots. Less than a week ago, these three independent MPs, Rob Oakeshott, Tony Windsor and Bob Katter, were virtual unknowns outside their own electorates and Parliament House.
How we resolve this difficult situation.
Now they wield enormous power.
And I get the irony that a new gang of four's in town. But I assure you, we act for good, not evil.
The recent federal election has transformed Australian politics. No longer do the two main political parties dominate the political scene. There's a new force in Canberra, and they're called the Independents. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and today on Rear Vision, here on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web, we take a look at the long and rather colourful role independents have played in Australia's political history. For most of the 20th century, the main political parties have dominated politics, but there were times when independents played a critical role. And according to historian and author Humphrey McQueen, prior to Federation in 1901, virtually all politicians were independents.
By the 1880s, people like Henry Parkes in New South Wales and the leaders of the protectionist movement in Victoria certainly had got together a group of pretty solid supporters who they could rely on. The problem was, of course, that people would defect from that, or they would not be able to stay in Parliament because there was no payment of members. So people would get elected and then they couldn't turn up, or they wouldn't turn up, or they'd drop out. So even a majority would become pretty unstable on you.
So in essence, when we look back at the period before Federation, in a sense there were lots of individuals who came together to form groupings, moved apart, were there, weren't there. So there was a much more sort of volatile political system in a sense.
Oh, far, far more. In fact, I mean, you know, it'd be a bit of an exaggeration to say there were only independents before the 1880s, but not much of an exaggeration.
It wasn't really until the late 19th century that you started to get what we'd regard as a stable party system emerging.
Brian Costa is Professor of Victorian Parliamentary Democracy at Swinburne University of Technology and the co-author of Rebel with a Cause, Independence in Australian Politics.
I mean, really, the formation of the Labor parties from 1890 onwards really gave that a push. Prior to that, you really were looking at parliamentary factions and even in some places virtually parliaments of independents, and their record wasn't all that good. There tended to be an avoidance of major issues. For example, the hot topic issue of the day in the 19th century was education, because it involved this question about religion in schools and whether there was to be Bible reading or whether there wasn't. And one of the reasons we were pretty slow at getting state education acts was because parliaments were reluctant to touch them, because the members were susceptible, of course, to outside influences in the sense of organised groups campaigning against them, and they had no protection from a party system.
So what happens at Federation and that first federal election? Do we see independents running, or is it very much along people running along party lines?
Oh, well, every man and his drover's dog was up to run in 1901, and indeed quite a few drover's dogs managed to get elected. There were a lot of what are called oncers who got themselves voted in 1901 and then didn't stand again or were defeated. I mean, a lot of them had a long way to travel. I mean, the people from Western Australia came across and didn't go home again till the next election. So the people over there had forgotten about them. So it's really in those early years of Federation when you've got three distinct groups. It was referred to as the period of the three Elevenses, where you had a free trade grouping, a protectionist grouping, and a Labor Party, which was actually sharply divided between the free traders and the protectionists. And that doesn't get sorted out until about 1910, when the Labor Party wins the first outright majority in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. And at that point, you really do begin to get strong caucus discipline in the Labor Party. It's there from the 1890s, but no one really pays much attention to it, and there's no one really to enforce it before about 1910. So things really have changed after the first 10 years of Federation, but in the beginning, it was open slather.
At the time of federation, women were suspicious of the growth of political parties, and many stood as independents in the early federal elections. Jennifer Curtin is senior lecturer in politics at the University of Auckland and the other co-author of Rebel with a Cause, Independence in Australian Politics.
They saw the parties as a hangover of the development coming out of a very male understanding of politics, and they felt that women hadn't been served well by male politicians prior to women getting the vote in 1902. So I suppose at the state level, there was a sense that women's moral and social and economic well-being wasn't being taken into account, that there were a lot of issues around child health and maternity that weren't being addressed. And so once women got the vote and the right to stand for parliament, there was this group of women that set up a woman voter newsletter, which was really active until about 1917, that disseminated a wide range of information about politics and policies that women voters should be interested in. And the women like Vida Goldstein, who stood on these sorts of issues to do with maternity allowances and the importance of recognising motherhood as something to be valued, and married women's property rights and those sorts of things, they really felt that the political parties were extremely male-dominated and needed women in there, and if they couldn't be there, certainly in the parliament, in order to ensure that women-friendly policies would result.
And did these women who stood as independents, like Vida Goldstein, did they come out of the suffragette movement?
Yes, many of them did. And so in that sense, we're not talking about a majority of women. Of course, there were women who were interested in voting for political parties. And we know that historically, the Liberal Party was actually the party that tended to receive more of the women's vote than the Labor Party for a long time. But these women that were active, like Vida Goldstein and others, yes, they were very active around the suffragist movement, but they were also really active around other issues like women's material well-being.
None of these women, even though there was quite a large number of them standing, actually ever got into Parliament at the federal level.
No, and I suppose that's perhaps symptomatic of the time too, that parties were increasingly gaining a hold. It's always been difficult in the Australian system for an independent to get elected because you have to get the 50% plus one of the vote in your electorate. And the first woman independent we see get elected is not until 1946, and that's Doris Blackburn. And interestingly, she was a campaign secretary for Vida Goldstein back in the early days. So she was a political animal in her own right, and her husband had held the seat but died, and so she stood as an independent, but she was from the left rather than from a rural conservative electorate.
And how long did she maintain her seat in federal parliament?
Only 3 years, yeah. And then in 1949, when Labor was trounced federally, she lost her seat. So she had a very short time, and her impact probably in the broader scheme of things would be quite small. But she certainly demonstrated that what independents can represent are not only electorate-specific issues, but sometimes national issues that don't necessarily get a hearing by the major parties who are attending to matters that their party have determined as primary or most important.
While at the federal level, independents didn't have an impact until the 1940s, at the state level, they did.
The most important single individual in a state parliament, of course, is Percy Brookfield, who in 1920 does have the balance of power. Both sides are evenly divided in the New South Wales parliament. Brookfield is amazingly the sole member from Broken Hill of the Industrial Socialist Labour Party. He's been in the ALP, he's been expelled, and he uses his position to do two things. One is to get proper health and safety for the miners in Broken Hill, and secondly, to get a royal commission into the jailing of the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, who had been put in jail for trying to burn down Sydney during the First World War. And the royal commission gets 10 of the 12 released. So he uses his power enormously, more, I think, than any other single individual. But, of course, he's shot and killed on a railway station in 1921. So it's a pretty glorious but very tragic end to it.
In the States, both historically and even up into the contemporary period, some of the states have had very significant independence. For example, in South Australia, the long run of the Liberal Country League government under Premier Playford was really underpinned by a selection of very small parties and independents, which kept them in power for quite some time. There's a lot of variation in independents. Victoria, for example, has proved very unwelcoming to independent MPs, even though they played a significant role in 1999, where they held the balance of power and negotiated a charter of good governance, which they eventually signed with the then leader of the opposition, Labor's Steve Brax, and of course that brought Labor to power. New South Wales, by contrast, has always had a lot of independent MPs, and for its size, so has Queensland. In fact, the longest serving state independent MP came from Queensland by the name of Tom Aitkins, who was sat in the parliament from 1944 to 1977, a record that I think is going to take a lot of beating.
This is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and today we're taking a look at the role independents have played in Australian politics since Federation. In 1940, a year after Australia entered World War II, a federal election was held. The incumbent government, a coalition of non-Labor parties led by Robert Menzies, gained an equal number of seats as the Labor bloc, led by John Curtin. Menzies was only able to hold on to power with the support of two independents, Alex Wilson and Arthur Coles. This was Australia's first hung parliament at the federal level. But as Humphrey McQueen explains, it was quite different from the situation today.
What Menzies was trying to do, hoping to do, was to bring the Labor Party into a coalition, a grand coalition like Churchill had established for the defence of the realm. But the Labor Party was seriously divided between a pro-communist group, a central group, and a Langite group who were half radical and half reactionary. And running through all of this, there was a very strong Irish Catholic notion that A, you didn't want to fight for the empire if you were Irish, and if you were Catholic, you supported Mussolini and the fascists because he was against the communists. So to move into a pro-war government would have split the Labour Party in at least two ways and possibly three or four. So the Labour Party wasn't prepared to come into government, nor was it anxious, nor its leaders, John Curtin, anxious to overthrow the Menzies government, because that meant that they would have then been in charge and all these divisions in the country would have blown up. So even though from the elections in 1940 you get an equal number of Labour and non-Labour plus two independents, one of the independents pointed out that there really wasn't a hung parliament because the opposition wasn't prepared to move a no-confidence motion or do anything to give them a chance to vote the government out. In October 1941, Menzies has been deposed as leader of the United Australia Party. As the Sydney Morning Herald said, he looked as amazed as Hamlet would have done had he been stabbed by Polonius. He's out of it. The new leader of the Country Party, Artie Fadden, comes in and is Prime Minister for 40 days and 40 nights. So there are good reasons for then for getting a stronger government. And the threat of Japan really, I think, is the thing that means that the independents and the Labour Party, and a lot of pressure on them both, to get rid of this hopeless now anti-Labour government that is so divided. So that's how, when they move this censure motion on the budget to reduce the first item by £1, the two independents now decide for their own different reasons. One, because he's so reactionary and wanted Menzies to stay. The other, because he's so radical and wants to do a good deal by the dirt farmers and stand up to the banks. Both of them come across and support Curtin as Prime Minister. But from 1940, for 15 months, although it appears that there's a hung parliament, in practice, there wasn't a hung parliament. Therefore, drawing any parallel between 1940 and 2010 is really an indication that you're not paying any attention to the context or the dynamics or the structure of what was going on in each case.
So tell me about these two independents, Alex Wilson and Arthur Coles, because as you said, sort of for 15 months, they held the balance, even though in a sense there wasn't a balance. But where did they come from and how did they get on together when they were such different characters?
Well, I don't think they needed to get on together. And indeed, they were very different characters. Coles was the man who ran the chain stores. He'd been Lord Mayor of Melbourne. He was a great Menzies supporter before he got elected as a kind of independent anti-Labor candidate. He was very right-wing politically. Now, meantime, you've got Wilson, who's the member for this very poor farming area in the Wimmera in Victoria. He's been elected in 1937. And while he's in the Country Party, he's not of the Country Party in one sense. He's part of this Victorian radical Country Party group. And he's got a whole range of policies that he wants, most of them to help the farmers out of the terrible financial situation, that overproduction of wheat in the 1920s and then the Depression. All of these economic catastrophes have brought on the small farmers in his electorate. And you've always got to remember that there was a war on. That's the real context that changes things. And that's how those two decided to come across and vote with the Labor Party to reduce the first item of the budget by £1. Fadden, as Prime Minister, was probably happy to hand it over, but the job was really beyond him. And Curtin and Evatt and Chifley and the others took over. And then, of course, the Americans arrive and we have a completely different political situation from 1942 onwards.
People are making that comparison with 1940, but in lots of ways is a better comparison, really, not 1940s when we were in the middle of a war and the parliament was very different. Should we be making comparisons perhaps with moments in the state system or the state parliaments where there have been minority governments who have worked with independents?
Yes, I think we should, simply because they're much more recent. We've had a number of these now where we've had minority governments. Many people are saying, isn't this strange that we've got a minority government federally and we haven't had one since 1940? But a glance at the states and the territories have shown us that in the last 10 to 12 years, we've had minority governments in all the jurisdictions. Western Australia is a bit strange because of that rather unusual coalition that's there between the Nats and the Libs. Now, most of those minority governments have had bolstering them agreements, written agreements between the party, which eventually became the government, and clutches of independents. Now, interestingly, most of them have been quite successful. If you gauge success as to mean stability and reasonable policy activity on the part of the government, that is not gridlock, only in Tasmania in 1989 and again in the early 1990s were those compacts unstable and produced a degree of policy gridlock. Now, there were very specific reasons for that. One is they were the first ones that were negotiated. They really didn't have much of a template. And secondly, my view about it is that the compacts that work best are those that are least policy specific. Whereas the Tasmanian Accord, as they were called, first with the Labor Party, which then fell apart, then with the Liberal Party, which then fell apart, they were very policy specific, particularly on the area of environment, because they were negotiated with green independents, as they were called. Remember, in those days, we never had a unified party called the Australian Greens. The Greens were very different from state to state. Now, the deal that they struck first with the Labor Party and then with the Liberal Party, in my opinion, was far too policy specific, which gave it an opportunity for trouble to break out. Whereas the one in Victoria here, which was very light on policy indeed, and where it did talk about policy, it tended to talk in general terms about assistance to regional and rural Victoria. Again, very similar to what we're probably going to get in the next week or so here federally. And it was heavy on parliamentary reform and accountability. And that accord, I think, is generally regarded as quite a success. And that, I think, should guide the independents, we don't know exactly how many there are going to be yet, in their negotiations with the two parties. I think they need to be quite firm on questions of parliamentary reform, electoral reform. They're the things they've talked about. But they need, I think, to be a little light in policy specifics.
Historically, has it been easier for independents to be elected to the House of Representatives or the Senate? And once they're there, how easy has it been for them to retain their seat?
Well, I think in terms of absolute numbers, there have probably been more independents in the lower house over time than there have been in the Senate, at least since proportional representation, although I do think it's harder to, in a way, to, as a true independent, like one person standing, it's very difficult to get elected to the Senate because most people vote above the line. And so Brian Harradine ran on a Brian Harradine group kind of ticket with his name up the top, which then allows him to have that box at the top because he's got a list of folks who are running with him underneath the line. But if I was just Bob Catter standing for Senate, and this was something Peter Andren, before he died, was looking at, it would be very difficult to garner enough votes to get your quota to get over the line because you wouldn't get to put your name above the line, and that's where something like 90% of voters put their tick. So there is that difficulty, if you like, with getting into the Senate. But once you're in the Senate, as an independent, it is much easier to do your work because it's an environment that is used to having independent thinkers there, and in times past it used to be much easier for members of the major parties, even inside the committees, to be able to relax their party line, if you like, and work together as across party lines on issues that mattered. So those sorts of norms, if you like, that are associated with the way the Senate works are probably foster a sense of being able to be a valued member of the Senate when you're an independent. I don't think it's as easy in the lower house, and also each independent in the lower house has to be across every single policy issue. They don't have anybody to sort of divvy up the workload to in the same way that members of parties do, when they can take areas of expertise and just respond accordingly to that particular area.
Why have so many of the recent independents at both the state and the federal level come from country electorates?
Yes, I think the reason why two-thirds of the independents that we've seen of recent times have come out of regional and rural Australia is because of what we could generally call structural adjustment. I mean, we all know that there have been specific challenges in regional and rural Australia by the removal of tariffs, for example, the reduction in subsidies, and also things that governments really didn't have any control of, that is the shrinking of bank branches and all those sorts of things, caused a backlash in regional Australia. And I suppose we saw it most dramatically in the One Nation phenomenon. Now, independents, of course, are another side of that coin. The independents that we've seen haven't run on issues of exclusion. In fact, what is really interesting is that perhaps the most prominent of those federal independents, the late Peter Andren, had policies on asylum seekers that were even to the left of the most left-wing of Labor people. Yet his constituents in Kalea kept re-electing him. And he claims that the reason they re-elected him is because he stood up for them. I remember him writing in his book, he said that people don't expect you to win every time, but they do expect you to make a genuine effort to help your local constituents. And he claims that by doing that, his local constituents were prepared to overlook, if you like, policy stances that he had. You know, he was very strong pro-Republican. He was very strong on tighter gun laws at a time when this was not popular in regional Australia. So it really is quite a complex relationship between these successful independents and their constituents. But I do think that the reason is that if we want to call it the neoliberal revolution, people in the cities generally were not at the sharp end of that change, whereas people in the regions were, and just as importantly, believed they were, which gave independents an opportunity to take seats away from the major parties. Now, the interesting thing here is, too, independents don't win marginal seats. Independents win seats that are very safe for one or other of the major parties. Now, because the coalition has more seats generally in regional Australia than Labor does, independents took very safe seats away from National Party particularly and Liberal MPs. Notice that the three current MPs, if they were not there, those seats would be occupied by National Party members. And the National Party is very upset about this, as you can imagine. But they have had no effect at getting them back, and those independents win their seats by very big margins.
So what makes a successful independent?
I'm wondering if you have to be, it sounds like a slogan though, you know, a man, except it could be a woman, of the people, so that you can, that you're comfortable walking along the street and engaging with the regular Joe and Josephine blogs about the matters that are happening in Parliament and being able to communicate well. I think you have to be resilient to be an independent, because major parties really hate independents. It's well known that at different times at the state and federal level, parliamentarians from the major parties have been quite awful to their independent parliamentary colleagues in terms of wanting them to feel isolated. So it must be really nice for three of them to be sitting there together so they can get a sense of support from each other that what they're working on matters. So I do think there has to be a resilience, because if you make a mistake as an independent, there's no one there to support you. But if you make a mistake as a party member, then the rest of the party can come in behind you and help support you. So I think that matters. And the other thing is that you have to be really good on the ground to help you raise money to do your campaign, because the campaign funding kinds of legislation or rules governing how you can raise money at the state and federal level are different often for independents than they are for parties. And so there's an element of discrimination in the system that can make it quite difficult for independents to, in the first instance, be elected and then be re-elected.
Are we witnessing a significant change in Australian politics, or merely the resurfacing of an old phenomenon?
Well, as I said, particularly in relation to those country party type people, that's a thing that's been under the surface. It breaks through and then it gets pushed down again. What I think is happening, though, at the same time, of course, is that, is there a Labor Party anymore? Has there been a Labor Party for the last 20 years? And if there isn't, then this ALP phenomenon has, of course, lost track of the people who'd supported it in the way in which the National Party had lost track of the people who'd supported the old Country Party. And there, I think, we've seen the defection across to the Greens, so that, in a way, while the candidate for Melbourne is, you know, nominated as a Green, he's being supported by the most radical of the trade unions down there, you get a kind of independent being elected for this central old Labor seat. So you get the Labor Party breaking up. And that, in a sense, I think, is a new phenomenon. How far it will go, whether the party can remake itself, which I would seriously doubt because the machine people aren't going to hand over control to anybody else, then I think we are perhaps on the verge of a remaking of that half of the political system. Whereas on this occasion, it's the non-Labor groups, the Liberal National Party, that is most united, partly because they've driven out a lot of the people who were small L Liberals who would have supported environmental protection and things. So you may well get a whole set of new realignments coming out of this. So in that sense, I think there is really the potential for a great novelty coming about, but not, I think, because we've got the three independent country members. That, I think, does have a much longer tradition.
Historian and author Humphrey McQueen. Our other guests were co-authors of Rebel Without a Cause, Independence in Australian Politics, Brian Costa and Jennifer Curtin. Thanks to sound engineer Judy Rapley, and to ABC Archives. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on ABC Radio National. Thanks for joining us.